It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Roughly 21,000 children are homeschooled in Pennsylvania every year. The legislature recently changed the state's oversight law. This week during Morning Edition, as part of 90.5 WESA's Life of Learning initiative, we're exploring homeschooling. Here to tell us more about the series is Kevin Gavin, executive producer of WESA's Life of Learning initiative. Kevin Gavin, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you as always, Paul.
Homeschooling is not new, so tell us what inspired this particular Life of Learning series.
Two things. One, in a sense, factual and quantifiable, and one was sort of anecdotal. We were, we were noticing just anecdotally some changes in the types of people, the types of parents who were homeschooling their children, and even the definition of homeschooling has changed a bit as how it's understood by parents. How it's sort of understood by state regulators is a different thing. The other thing is the change in law that you mentioned that happened in fall that took effect not long thereafter.
So what issues regarding homeschooling will this series address?
Well, to the fact of how the change in law is affecting homeschooling, yes, we're looking at a lot about that, how it's actually loosened up the regulations on parents in Pennsylvania who do not have their children attend the typical brick-and-mortar school, and also how the children's education is monitored and evaluated who are not educated in those schools, the local elementary school, et cetera, et cetera. Plus, also, we're going to look at testing, evaluation, and socialization of the children. That was always one of the, you know, worrisome things. Are these kids going to be socially active because they're not going to be in schools with kids of their own age, et cetera, and how's that going to affect their overall development in addition to their education?
I mean, and homeschooling has been around for a while, so what have we learned to this point about socialization and the questions it raises?
Well, that's just it. You know, we mentioned about the definition of homeschooling. It's not just that parent who sits down with their child and teaches them geography and English and history, et cetera, all the subject matters that we would grow up with and have as a little, maybe a little classroom in their home or anything like that. It's education in the home. Maybe some of it is done that way. It's education among parents who are homeschooling parents. They get together and decide who's the best teacher for this particular subject. And there are lots and growing number of organizations where people actually go to another facility and the kids learn together. So it's out of the typical public school, private school learning is what it is. Plus, there's the cyber component as well.
Is homeschooling on the rise in Pennsylvania?
Not necessarily. It is it's not growing, it's not falling at this point. It has grown since homeschooling, the first law in 1988. But there are concerns about that. Jim Buckeit, for example, he's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators. He's a little bit concerned about the no oversight. Now, obviously, he's got a sort of a dog in the fight, if you would. He has an interest, Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators, the typical brick and school. He's worried about the loosening up of the rules here in Pennsylvania done by those changes in law.
Unless there is a complaint or some reason for the school district to believe that an education is not taking place, without having a direct oversight of that, there would be no ability to intercede on the child's behalf to make sure they're going to be properly educated.
Okay, so that's the traditional perspective on this, but is there another side?
Oh, there certainly is, Paul, because a lot of parents are quote, homeschooling by either having their kids attend cyber charter schools or online academies that are actually run by the local school districts. However, you know, there's the thought that innovation has actually happened from homeschooling, and John Edelson is the president of Time for Learning.
I think a lot of the future movements where the students work more at their own pace and have more independence and make more use of technology will continue to be developed in homeschooling, where they're free to take more chances and move quickly.
WESA's Life of Learning features on homeschooling air This week during Morning Edition, Kevin Gavin is WESA's executive producer of the Life of Learning Initiative. Kevin, as always, great thanks.
Thank you very much, Paul.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The inaugural Pittsburgh Humanities Festival was held over the weekend, and the man described as the godfather of independent film, John Sayles, who has written and directed more than 17 films, including Lone Star, Eight Men Out, and my favorite, The Brother from Another Planet, spoke on the topic of independent films, along with his producing partner, Maggie Renzi. He joins us by phone. John Sayles, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me on.
In 1979, you turned the film world on its ear a bit when you made The Return of the Secaucus Seven, in which seven baby boomers with ties to the anti-war movement of the 1960s get together for a weekend, and what should be a peaceful reunion ends up being filled with drama. This was a time when America was finally starting to come to grips with Vietnam, and there were no big-name movie stars in your cast. How risky was this undertaking back then, John?
Well, you know, I was risking my own $40,000. I had started working as a screenwriter out in Hollywood, and I had worked as an actor and director in a summer theater, and the head of that summer theater, Jeffrey Nelson, said, "We know so many good actors. Why don't we just make a movie? You've got movie connections now." And it's actually the only time that I've written a movie very specifically based on how much money I had in my pocket. So I asked myself, what can I do well for $40,000, and I knew all these good actors who were turning 30, and I said, so it's going to be a movie about people turning 30.
It was one of the last big Washington marches, and we all ended up going down from Boston in a station wagon.
Which Jeff had borrowed from a friend of his.
An acquaintance.
Some dude he thought he knew real well.
We didn't all know each other that well yet. It was me and Katie and Jeff and Mara and JT and Irene and Francis. Francis was the other one. We get on the Jersey Turnpike, and we're low on gas, so we get off in Secaucus.
Right where you pick up the Lincoln Tunnel?
In 2 seconds, we're busted.
Every cop on the Eastern Seaboard was out that weekend trying to pick off pinkos on their way to Washington.
The guy looks in the back of our trunk.
No warrant or anything.
At first, we thought the guy who loaned us the car was an FBI plant who set us up.
Turned out he was just stupid.
So we spend the night in the cooler.
Adjoining cells for men and women, segregated from the rest of the prisoners.
Right, so we don't poison their minds, right?
We get hysterical, calling ourselves the Secaucus Seven and doing numbers from Jimmy Cagney and George Raft and what was that movie?
Salt of the Earth.
Right. We want the formula. We want the formula.
I think some of it was a reaction. There had been some articles, you know, where are the protesters? What's happened to them in things like Time magazine saying, oh, they've all gone corporate and they're, you know, they've taken straight jobs. And that just wasn't my experience. The people that I was living around at that time, I was living in East Boston. And they were people who had been in VISTA, which was the domestic Peace Corps. And they were, all of the men were probably making a lot less money than their fathers had at the same point in their lives. And most of the women, as well as the men, were involved in some kind of social organizing, whether within a school district or, you know, running halfway houses or whatever. And were, even though the world hadn't changed in the way that they wanted it to, they were still trying to do what they could.
And what kind of return were you expecting on your investment, John? What did you think would happen once this movie got out there?
The most I hoped for is that the next time I wrote a script on my own and said, oh, I'd like to direct this, and they say, well, ha, what have you ever directed? I would have something to show them. So I actually did not expect it to get a theatrical release, which it eventually did in 1980. It took about 2 years to get the movie, you know, a distributor and then to release it. So it was actually a surprise that it ended up showing in theaters and getting reviews and all that kind of thing.
And so when that happened, what did it do not only for you, but just for independent films in general?
Well, for me, I always say that I was catapulted from total obscurity to relative obscurity. So I got a couple writing jobs. Nobody offered me a directing job. I think for independent film, our movie and, you know, maybe a half dozen other movies that came out at that time kind of you know, created this little wave that turned into the independent film movement. And, you know, that has to be a two-way street. It's not just people making the movies. It's audiences saying, I'm going to go to a theater. I've never heard of any of these actors. I've never heard of this director, but I hear interesting things about it, or it's about a subject that I'm interested in. I'm going to give it a chance. And just economically, that came at a time when the so-called art theaters realized, well, we can't just keep showing Truffaut's 400 Blows because there's this new thing called video and people can own that movie if they want to see it again. We got to find something else to show and maybe give it an open run. So our timing, without knowing it, was very good for, you know, this kind of phenomenon that I think lasted for about 25 years.
And independent films were flourishing for a time. What is the state of independent films today?
Well, certainly more of them are being made than ever. The technology of making a film because of digital photography, and instead of having to buy film stock and get it developed and all that kind of stuff, which could be, you know, a third to half of your cost on a low-budget movie. That's minimal now, the cost of actually recording the thing. That's made it more kind of democratic and possible to make a film. And also just the proliferation of film schools means more people who are 18 years old to 22 years old actually have a very good idea technically how to make a movie. However, there's still this bottleneck, which is distribution and exhibition. And so the Sundance Film Festival may get 2,000 new features submitted every year, and they may, you know, show maybe 40 in their festival, and maybe 10 of those get any kind of theatrical release. So the pyramid is much wider, but it's still a very narrow point at the top of it. So yes, it's still possible, but there's not really a business there anymore.
And so if it's a situation where a film can be good, there can be a good story, but even that isn't enough to ensure a distribution deal, you know, what does that say about the state of films today? And are we stuck with only the movies that guarantee a huge return, that are going to be a blockbuster, that have big name stars? You know, when are some of the other films that are being made going to get the opportunities that some of your films in the past have gotten?
Well, I think you kind of got to go back to just before the early 70s. There were film clubs. There were, you know, people showed movies in churches. You know, the first subtitled films I ever saw were, you know, on the wall of some basement somewhere that somebody got a print and decided to show it. And it was kind of like searching the web for something that interested you. A lot of movies live and die on the web right now. They're made outside of the Hollywood system, and they are made available for download and never play in a theater. So it's a bit, you know, the only problem for that as far as somebody having a film career as a director or any of the other things that go into making a film is that if it lives and dies on the web, there's probably not a whole lot of money passing hands. So that kind of business hasn't really been monetized yet. So certainly it's a great time to be a movie audience. It's not as great a time to be somebody who's trying to make a career in making movies.
Writer, director, and the man they call the godfather of independent film, John Sayles, joining us by phone. John, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. Central Pittsburgh, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In a time where we've seen massive layoffs as well as cutbacks and closings at newspapers and some electronic news gathering organizations, it might be reasonable to assume that the golden age of investigative journalism is behind us. Radio and TV networks and even some local stations still have investigative reporters, but it's traditionally been the print outlets that have dedicated the resources and manpower to the craft. But author Anya Shiffrin, whose most recent book is called Global Muckraking, 100 Years of Investigative Reporting from Around the World, might beg to differ. She says from Asia to Africa to Latin America, muckrakers have corrupt officials and corporate cronies on the run. Ms. Schifrin is the director of the Media and Communications Specialization Department at Columbia University School of International Affairs. She spent 10 years herself working overseas as a journalist in Europe and Asia, and she's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the City of Asylum in an event co-sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh. She joins us now by phone. Anya Schifrin, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You wrote in an online piece that when you began researching your book, Global Muckraking, you assumed that the good old days of investigative reporting were in the past. But what did you learn?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Paul. We all remember when we think of great investigative journalists, we think of the muckrakers like Ida Tarbell and Upton Sinclair and Lincoln Steffens, who took on the terrible American corporations and wrote about things like the banks and the trusts, the monopolies, and food safety in Chicago and the conditions of the workers and the processing plants and meat business. And so I had thought that was the sort of good old days of investigative journalism. And as I started to do the research for my book, Global Muckrakers, I learned a few major things. One is that there was investigative journalism happening all over the world over the last 150 years, and that today those traditions still continue in many, many places. So I came away starting to feel a lot more cheerful about investigative journalism and where it's at. One of the interesting things, I'll talk more about the book, but one of the interesting things about it is that many of the contributors in the book who are alive now are still getting in trouble. So Rafael Marquez from Angola, who's done a lot of exposure of corruption in Angola, especially tied to the ruling family and the oil companies, he's actually on trial right now, and Nick Kristof has been writing about him. Khadija Ismailova, a radio journalist from Azerbaijan, who's also been writing about corruption there. There's a lot of oil wealth in that country, and again, the ruling family has helped themselves. She also was arrested a couple of months ago. So the risks that these sort of brave investigative journalists have taken are still causing problems for them around the world. So that's been something that we're all sort of focused on right now. I think that in terms of investigative journalism, we're seeing there's so much corruption out there. There's so much sort of corporate misdoing that there's plenty of material for journalists. And the internet has made it easier to do cross-border investigations. So that's something that we're seeing now that we didn't see 10 or 20 or 50 years ago. So I know an editor in Chicago who's sitting and editing right now journalists who are in Africa. And there's a lot of good examples. One cross-border investigation that was published last year was the ICIJ's piece written by Leslie Wayne, edited by Mike Hudson, on tax avoidance. And this was a series of articles about how Luxembourg has been writing these so-called comfort letters to large American companies like Coach Handbags, letting them be domiciled in Luxembourg and therefore avoid their taxes around the world. So a number of European newspapers researched the story together and then published on the same day. And again, with social media and with digital technology, it's just much, much easier now for journalists who used to be isolated to get large amounts of data, to work together to verify it and write it, and then to work together to release it on the same day. So that's one of the reasons we're seeing a lot of good cross-border investigations right now.
So you have the topics, the things that are out there to be investigated. You have the technology. But what else is making this possible, particularly from a financial standpoint?
Absolutely. So I would say social media, I would say new technology are two reasons. I would say political transition. There's a lot of countries in the world where the press is freer now than it was, and there has been transition. So let's take Singapore and Malaysia. Used to have very repressive media climates. They're not totally free now, but they're freer than they were. Burma, Tunisia, even places like Vietnam and China are freer now than they were 30 or 40 years ago. So political transition is opening up spaces in many, many countries for more reporting. Another thing is philanthropy. There are wealthy individuals all over the world that are supporting the media now. Every country I go to, there's some rich person underwriting an outlet. Sometimes they're liberal do-gooders who want to expose corruption and want to promote media and care about free expression. Sometimes they're, you know, cronies who have business interests, but there's just a lot of people supporting new outlets. And then charitable foundations, people like the Open Society or Gates or Omidyar, some Silicon Valley millionaires, are giving money to investigative reporting. ProPublica would be a good example. So there's philanthropic money. I don't know how long it's going to last, and I don't know whether or not many of these foundations will start sort of demanding proof of impact and get disappointed, because journalism, it's often really hard to know whether the stories make a difference in the short term. And then I would say that the final reason is, unfortunately, all these layoffs in the established media houses mean that there's a lot of talent of people, you know, age 50 and upwards who have fantastic institutional memory, are great journalists with decades of experience. And they're now teaming up with some of the younger people, the younger journalists who know how to use data and are really good at new technology. And they're working together on a lot of stories. So I think for those reasons, we're at a good moment right now.
Let me jump in, Anya, because one of the things that has people concerned is that while all of these things that you've pointed out have made the climate rich for investigative journalism, at the same time, has the life of a journalist ever been cheaper? It seems that they are more under attack these days than ever before.
Well, certainly, I think it depends who you talk to. So according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, I think 70 journalists were killed last year. And Joel Simon has published a wonderful book called New Censorship, in which he argues that digital technology and the internet have made exactly life cheaper for journalists, that in many countries, because of the layoffs in places like the New York Times, large media houses are using freelancers and less well-known reporters to cover news, and they're more vulnerable. So if you're in a dangerous country where journalists are often killed, let's say take somewhere like Mexico or Russia, if you're not well-known and you don't have the protection of sort of a staff job with a big outlet, your life is cheap and you can be bumped off much more easily. Ditto what's happening in Syria and Iraq with ISIS. They're killing journalists in order to demonstrate how scary they are. And some of the media houses are now saying they're not going to take freelance work from that region because it just encourages journalists to go out and take risks. But in my book, we excerpt 47 pieces of investigative, campaigning, human rights journalism from around the world over the last 100 years. So we have pieces from, you know, the Congo and China and Colombia. And I'll say that a lot of the journalists who are featured in our collection, in our book Global Muckraking, they were killed too, and they were sent to jail. So it's bad now. Whether or not it's worse than it was 100 years ago, I'm not sure. Probably it is, but it may also be that we hear about it more because, as I say in the book, news travels faster now, even if it's ignored when it arrives. So there's a lot more journalism going on and a lot more people probably producing news than there were 150 years ago. But that also means that when they expose something terrible, like a shocking labor condition or a case of slavery or trafficking, it can be harder to get attention now than it was.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Anya Shiffrin, author of Global Muckraking, 100 Years of Investigative Reporting from Around the World. In the book, you draw on some specific examples of some extraordinary pieces of investigative journalism going back a century or more.
That's right. And what I try to do is sort of compare the pieces from 100 years ago to the pieces today, and then talk about when they had impact and if they had impact, you know, why. And sometimes things were ignored. So, for example, we have a piece about the 1906 boycott of Cadbury chocolate because of labor conditions in Sao Tome and Principe, next to a piece from Fortune magazine by Christian Parenti about terrible conditions on the cocoa plantations in West Africa more than 100 years later. So we have stories on Nike, on the labor conditions at Foxconn, at Liz Claiborne, next to pieces from 100 years ago. The book is divided into themes, so we have stories about labor, we have stories about corruption, we have stories about oil, gas, and mining, about famine. And that way the reader can see how different countries and different journalists treated those same subjects at different periods of time.
How do you compare investigative journalism, the state of investigative journalism in the United States, to what is happening around the world? Are we doing it differently than other journalists in other countries are?
Well, I think that in the U.S. we have a good tradition of investigative journalism, and I would say probably we're making more use of things like data and what used to be called computer-assisted reporting. I would say our stories tend to be probably very well sourced as well. There's so many good examples. I help every year judge the Human Rights Journalism Prize given by the Overseas Press Club. And our problem is it's a great problem to have. We read dozens and dozens of entries every year. Some of my favorites, I thought that this year the Al Jazeera documentaries were absolutely superb. There was one about the American army bases in Afghanistan where the U.S. government is hiring contractors who hire people like the dishwashers and the maintenance staff, and they often come from poorer countries in Asia, and they're actually paying to get those jobs. So they're being horribly exploited. The U.S. government's paying subcontractors maybe $6 an hour, but by the time it gets down to the dishwasher from southern India, they're getting paid $1 an hour. So Al Jazeera did a really superb documentary showing this. There's a journalist from the Associated Press who I've never met who writes on Central America, and he's done incredible series of stories about what's happening in Honduras and the complete breakdown of law and order due to the drug gangs and how dangerous life has become there for normal people. And last year we were all wondering about the sudden burst of immigration into the United States from Central America. I thought back to the stories and how good they were. There's Bloomberg has done fantastic work on labor conditions in the iPhone 5 factories in Malaysia. Again, Nepali workers had paid to get the jobs, were underpaid, were deprived. Their contracts ran out. They were left in these warehouses with no food. LA Times has done a superb series on Mexican workers in California and how they're being treated. So there's really some great journalism being produced around the world. And I would say that the U.S. journalists are doing some of the best stuff I've seen. But
So the question becomes, is this sustainable? What does the future hold?
That's right. So I think one of the lessons also, again, from my book is that the outlets historically that produced investigative and campaigning journalism, most of them don't survive. So it's extremely expensive. And historically, you'd have like one person setting up a magazine or a little newspaper, publishing for a few years, like E.G. Morel, who exposed the conditions in the Congo in the 19th century under King Leopold, or Benjamin Saldana Roca, who had a newspaper in Peru that talked about how terrible the conditions were in the Amazon Rubber Company, which was listed in London. So historically, you've had sort of one, passionate people, Carlos Cardozo in Mozambique. They go out, they publish a pamphlet or a newsletter, and they write the story to death, and then they go do something else later on, and their outlet doesn't survive. So I think that there's a lot of sort of historical precedent for the idea that these places, outlets, it's not sustainable. It doesn't make any money. It's incredibly expensive. So I think we're in a good moment now, but I think that the future will hold more philanthropic funding, more foundations getting involved. Clearly, advertising rates are collapsing around the world, thanks partly to new technology. So I can't promise there's going to be great investigative journalism in the future, but I can say that we should really enjoy what there is right now, because there's a lot right now.
Anya Shiffrin is the author of Global Muckraking, 100 Years of Investigative Reporting from Around the World. That is her latest book. She is also the director of Media and Communication Specialization at Columbia University's School of International Affairs. And she's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the City of Asylum in an event co-sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh. Anya Shiffrin, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, from crusading journalists around the world to the story of a pioneering African-American woman journalist, we'll talk with James McGrath Morris, author of Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. That's next when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As we have commemorated the 50th anniversary of two milestones in the civil rights movement this month, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the name of Ethel Payne has remained largely unspoken. In the nation's capital, she became one of only three accredited African Americans in the White House press corps during the 1950s, where she made national headlines by rankling President Eisenhower with her questions about desegregation policy. And when President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he invited Payne to be one of the observers in the East Room. So why have her contributions been largely overlooked by civil rights historians? I'm joined now in Studio A by James McGrath Morris, author of Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. His other books include Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print and Power, which the Wall Street Journal called one of the five best books on American moguls. He is also in Pittsburgh as part of his book tour for an event tonight at the Big Idea Bookstore, as well as being a columnist and a radio show host. James McGrath Morris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Ethel Payne wrote for the Chicago Defender, and Pittsburghers would know of her work because it appeared in the Pittsburgh Courier. Describe how the black press operated in a different parallel sphere from the white press.
Well, like everything in the 20th century, black institutions remained entirely invisible to whites. They operated on their own. I'll give you an example. When the Great Migration sparked the movement of African Americans to Chicago, they got to Chicago, life was better, but they were still excluded from Chicago's economy, Chicago's social life. So they created their own cosmetic companies, their own banks, their own taxi cab companies, everything on their own, including the Chicago Defender, which was the leading black newspaper of the time. And one of the misnomers is to call it the Chicago Defender. It's no more merely a Chicago paper than, say, the New York Times is merely a New York newspaper. It had national significance. It helped trigger the mass migration. It covered the civil rights movement in a way that the white press was ignoring it. And it also changed the national agenda. Specifically, when you said that Ethel Payne rankled Eisenhower, he certainly did. But her questions also helped change the national agenda.
And we'll get to that specific incident in a bit. How did Ethel Payne distinguish herself?
Well, she distinguished herself in a number of ways. One of the things is that she had a journalistic eye. And that's, you know, when you meet reporters, you know, some just see the world as a story and others don't. She's one of those who saw the world as a story. She was untrained. And I was on a radio show in Washington, and the host is also the host of a jazz show. And he said to me, and I thought, gosh, I wish I'd talked to him before I'd written the book, that she was like a jazz artist, learning on the band as opposed to learning in schools. So she made a lot of journalistic mistakes when she first started at age 40, her new career as a journalist. But she had that eye of understanding what was the story, and that's what she pursued with incredible tenacity.
She didn't necessarily write glowingly of the civil rights legislation the way...
Oh, that's critically important, Paul. You're really on something very important. In looking back at that time, if you pull all the New York Times, the Washington Post, that era, the major legislative victories like the 57 Civil Rights Act, which she, when she covered it, she nailed Lyndon Johnson, then Majority Leader, and Senator John F. Kennedy, both running for president, both unwilling to be ahead of the curve on what they might have called Negro rights back then. She nailed them as they came off the floor, pointing out that they were gutting this bill, taking out the important parts. But eventually, when those bills were passed, the 57 Civil Rights Act, 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voting Rights Act, the white press portrayed these as munificent gifts being given to blacks. And you notice the kind of passivity of that term and the way it's a patronizing. The black press, particularly Ethel Payne, saw these as victories claiming and taking action to obtain the rights that already belonged to us but were being denied to us. That duality really shapes a lot of African-American consciousness about the white press to this very day. And that's part of the reason why later in the 60s, whites were really befuddled when they saw civil unrest. Because in a sense they were saying, well, what else do these folks want? Well, that's because they were seeing it through the eyes of the white press, where all these wonderful things have been given to them. And then black Americans were marching forward trying to obtain what was rightfully theirs. And Ethel Payne was always on the front lines of the civil rights movement, portraying that with that tone.
And pointing out that these things were happening a century, these civil rights breakthroughs, if you will, were happening a century after or nearly a century after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War, when the playing field was and newspapers like the Pittsburgh Gazette, for example,
sure.
as was pointed out yesterday, were actually writing editorials saying it's time to give civil rights to African Americans, and of course, it doesn't happen until many, many years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been why she took a less than reverent tone on this issue when she confronted President Eisenhower. We have a clip of this, but why don't you go ahead and set up exactly what happens in
well,
this?
Well, Ethel Payne comes to Washington as a Washington correspondent, the third black member of the White House press corps. And beginning innocently with asking some questions, she begins to learn that by merely asking a question in a national press conference, it forced the mainstream, i.e. white media, to cover the story. So when she worked with Clarence Mitchell, who's the NAACP lobbyist in Washington, to hone her questions and to get more and more specific with her questions about civil rights, when she asked the question, she educated the other 197 white reporters to the issue. She, in fact, educated the president. He often didn't know what the issue was. But her question, his answer, forced the white media the next day to cover an issue they weren't paying attention to.
So we won't hear Ethel Payne's voice in this clip, but
we're going to hear his answer?
We're going to hear his answer.
I can set that up for you.
Why don't you?
What happens is that Eisenhower keeps calling on her, thinking it's a good thing. She increasingly asks harder and harder questions. And on this particular day, she asks him if he is willing to support an initiative to desegregate interstate bus travel. And this hits a nerve with him.
Let's listen to the president's reaction.
Well, I don't know what right you say that you have to have administration support. The administration is trying to do what it thinks to be believed decent and just in this country.
Well, what he's saying then, and he goes on just a little further to say he wouldn't do anything for a special group. The room went dead quiet at that moment because every reporter realized that what Eisenhower had said is that the quest for equality by a large segment of Americans, i.e. black Americans, was no different than a special interest group, say the farm lobby coming to town. And he had made a huge blunder. The next day, every newspaper covered this. So everyone across the country read that interstate bus travel was segregated, which they might not have known. They read about the president's position, which was defensive. And they read about his regard for the civil rights movement as being a special interest group. As a result, he did not call on Ethel Payne again for a question. He learned his lesson.
And that clip, courtesy of the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum, and we're talking with James McGrath Morris. He is author of Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. And again, he's in Pittsburgh as part of his book tour for an event tonight at Big Idea Bookstore, joining us here in Studio A to talk about Ethel Payne, this extraordinary woman who did extraordinary work as a journalist. How would you describe her relationship with Lyndon Johnson, who actually ended up inviting her to the signing ceremonies of the civil rights legislation and also the Voting Rights Act?
She grew to love Johnson after hating him, basically. When she saw him as the Senate Majority Leader and saw him gut all of the progress that could be made legislatively speaking in civil rights, she's not a person who ever filled with hatred, so I shouldn't say she hated him, but she really disliked what he was doing, and she constantly nailed him. And when he was chosen as vice president by Kennedy, she was highly suspicious. She was at the Democratic National Convention. A telegram went out inviting anyone who was African American at the convention, press, whatever, to come to a meeting. And Johnson pledged to them at that moment that he would do a lot to advance civil rights. And, of course, they were very skeptical, the senator from Texas who'd done everything to stop civil rights. But he was aware that he was changing his constituency. If he won the White House, he had a national constituency, not just the as vice president, not just the Texan. And he was true to his word. And I think that endeared him to her, and she just ended up having high, high regard for him. And she went to one of his very last appearances after he was president at the LBJ Library, and she covered his talk, and it was sort of like the old warrior is still going on. And of course, she was getting older then, but her regard for him was very high. And the significance of all this is, of course, he gave her a pen at the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act. A lot of Americans don't understand.
A pen with which the act was signed.
Yeah, and a lot of Americans don't understand this is all this tradition in signing legislation. When Obama signed the National Health Care Bill, he had an array of pens, mm-hmm. and he'd make part of his O and put the pen down and part of the O with another pen, and then he'd hand them. And it usually goes to legislators who helped make the bill possible. So Johnson handed them to people like Everett Dirksen and others who had made the bill possible, also handed them to Martin Luther King and other activists. But Ethel Payne was among those selected for that crowd because he understood what a critical role she had played from the front lines of the civil rights movement, both in Washington, but also importantly in places like Montgomery, at risk of her life, to connect her readers with what was going on. So by merely reporting on the bus boycott when Martin Luther King was unknown, she was activating readers in other parts of the country, and that's what he was recognizing at that moment.
Melissa on Twitter says, Ethel Payne is one of my idols, self-taught, fire-tested, public-approved. Thank you for that comment, Melissa. And you can join Melissa with a comment or question on Twitter at ESSPGH, or you can email us at ESSPGH at WESA.FM, or join the conversation if you would like at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Ethel Payne was the granddaughter of slaves and the daughter of a Pullman porter. How did she grow up? You mentioned she did not become a reporter until she was 40. So what was happening in her life up until that point?
Doors were closed. I mean, she grew up in Southside Chicago, but she grew up in a different part of Southside Chicago. Her neighborhood, she describes, as being like an island surrounded by a sea of whiteness. As a result, she was able to walk to white facilities. And she went, for instance, to Lynn Bloom High School, which was the jewel of the white school system. So much so that when I first began this research, I heard a story that Ethel Payne had had Hemingway's English teacher. Now, if you're a biographer like me, you take everything with, yeah, sure. In fact, my first editor said to, as he often do to young journalists, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. So in this case, I checked it out, and it turned out, indeed, she had left Oak Park to come to Lynn Bloom. And the significance of that story is maybe not as much how she shaped Ethel Payne, but proof that this was a really incredible high school. So she gets out of high school. She does some community school. She gets a degree and all these different things. But every door is closed to her. 7 out of 10 African-American women in Chicago who get a job in the 1930s and 40s worked as domestic servants. The idea of a professional woman who's black was just unheard of. So she became a civil rights activist, and a number of circuitous paths led to her becoming a reporter. But that's the reason she didn't become a reporter until age 40.
And how did she end up becoming a writer and reporter?
Well, she ended up going to Japan to work as a service club hostess. The military was still segregated in 1948. Despite Truman's edict desegregating the military, General MacArthur never listened to Truman no matter what, and he kept the troops separated. She worked as a service club hostess in Japan for a black service club, and she observed the fraternization between black soldiers and Japanese women. Japan was destitute at this point, so any young soldier with money was an attractive target for women. I shouldn't say target, but, you know, relationships.
Sure.
And as a result, there were a lot of babies born of these unions. And the black babies, the mixed race babies, was really a problem for Japan because they're so xenophobic, so homogenic about their sense of race. These babies were abandoned, killed, and left in orphanages. So Ethel Payne was writing about it, but she had no place to publish this work except her diary. And when Alex Wilson from the Chicago Defender came to Japan to cover the Korean War, he learned about her work. He got it published in the Defender. It made a scandalous story back home and got her into trouble with the commander-in-chief in Japan. And the end result was the Chicago Defender, who gotten her in trouble, offered her a job. But it shouldn't be thought that they offered her a job because they got them in trouble. They offered her a job because they recognized in her this journalistic talent.
And her career took her to many places on the front lines of history.
She at first went to the front lines of the civil rights movement in the U.S., went to Montgomery at enormous risk. I mean, think about this is a black woman going south who also holds the title of reporter, something segregationists fear. But she saw very early on the connection between the black freedom struggle in the United States with the black freedom struggle around the world of self-determination. So as early as 1955, she was traveling around the world. She went to Africa a dozen times. She constantly reported and made those connections. And she was one of the earliest American reporters to talk about apartheid. In the 1950s, a U.S. ship was docking in South Africa. The military, the Navy is desegregated, mind you. The government was telling the black soldiers that they would have to go to colored bathrooms once they got on ground. And she was reporting about that. This is one of the great distinctions between the black press and the white press. The black press kept the feet of leaders on the fire all the time, and the white press was always scrambling to catch up with the story.
Ethel Payne left journalism for 9 years, then returned with a special assignment from the Defender, 3 months in Vietnam, to assess how the war was viewed by black troops. What did she and ultimately we learn from that?
Well, she went with the focus, as you say, about black troops. The war was terribly significant to African Americans because it was the first desegregated war. You could actually find white soldiers taking orders from black officers, or black soldiers and white soldiers going to combat together. She went, in a sense, myopically to cover only that story. And she did cover a lot of so-called good news stories about better relations, some really disastrous situations. But by her own admission, she missed the bigger story. She was so well handled by the government media and focused so much on just race relations, she missed the fact that the body count made no sense anymore. I mean, by this point, we'd wiped out all of North Vietnam, Korea. I mean, name six other nations. And so she regrets that in the sense of not having seen that. But her coverage was really interesting. It was very much like Ernie Pyle's coverage in World War II. Very personal, very much directed at each soldier. She often carried the soldier's home address in the copy with a hint that maybe somebody should be writing to him. These are kids, after all, 3,000 miles away from home. It's a very personal form of coverage.
You don't flinch from your status as a white male chronicling the life of an African-American female. What kind of support did you receive from Ethel Payne's family members and acquaintances?
Turned out I had no issues on that score. The issue was more my own. I mean, I really wondered, and I say it as somewhat as a joke, is, you know, can a white guy, white bald guy write a story about a black female who became famous writing about a white bald president? And what I discovered is that there was no resistance in the African-American community, as far as I could find. Her friends who are loyal to her were thrilled. Her family was supportive. What I learned was more about myself. And I wrote a piece about this called Reporting Across the Color Line. It was not hard for me as a trained journalist to jump into another culture. What was hard was confronting my own racism and my own language, my own sentence construction. A sentence that says there are three black reporters in the room, the way we write presumes that the other 197 are white. That kind of reflection on my writing was really what Ethel Payne's gift was to me.
And we should end by looking at Ethel Payne's legacy. We have a soundbite of her from an interview that she did with C-SPAN explaining why newsrooms need to be diverse from management to editorial staff.
We just do not have enough of minority representation at the policy level. It makes a great deal of difference because it influences the way the news is dispensed, the way the news is handled.
In terms of her pioneering efforts, what kind of a legacy does Ethel Payne leave in terms of people seeing black journalists and black women journalists and maybe just women journalists in general in a different light?
She leaves a lot of legacies, and if you had another hour, go on. But let me pick one. One of the legacies is her story is a constant reminder of who has a seat at the table makes an enormous difference. And as each group begins to gain rights, gay rights, transsexual rights, Hispanic rights, whatever group, if those folks are not at the table, not asking questions of those in power, the groups who are there will fail to ask the questions that are significant for that audience.
Last thing, we have about 30 seconds. Okay. What about her high school naming its journalism program after her?
The school where she could write for her school paper but was denied a position on the paper staff has renamed its journalism room the Ethel Payne Journalism Center. And so each succeeding number of kids who come into that room over the coming years will probably Google Ethel Payne, learn her story, and may be encouraged to follow her path.
It is an amazing story, and it's all chronicled in the book written by our guest, James McGrath Morris. It's Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. Again, Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. And it came out in November.
February, just 3 weeks ago.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Or 4 weeks ago.
It's on bookshelves now, and James McGrath Morris is in Pittsburgh as part of his book tour for an event tonight at the Big Idea Bookstore. James McGrath Morris, thank you again for joining us.
Pleasure chatting.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Tomorrow on the program, continuing in the vein of prominent women journalists, Cokie Roberts joins us. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.